This podcast is brought to you by Mobley & Sons. I actually stopped in Mobley & Sons just a few weeks ago, have some alterations done. They were great, really helpful, had a great time in there. Mobley & Sons has an unmatched selection of men's clothing combined with superior customer service. They've served as a fine men's clothier since 1969. Go check them out. They'll get you looking good for the big game. Welcome back to the Bama Beat. I'm Ben Jones. We're continuing our podcast series looking at each of the Alabama football coaches in between Coach Bryant and Coach Saban. We've got Cecil Hurt in here today to talk. How are you doing, Cecil?
Great. How are you?
We've got Taylor Watson from the Bryant Museum. Taylor, thank you for joining us again.
Well, I appreciate you having me back.
Yeah. We're on to Mike DuBose now. We've reached the Mike's portion of this series. Mike DuBose, Mike Price, Mike Shula, all to come. We'll get the first one knocked out here. So when we left this off last time, Gene Stallings had ridden off into the sunset of his Texas ranch, decided to retire. Alabama was probably at the best position that it was going to be in many ways, in between Coach Bryant and Coach Saban, though there were some NCAA issues lingering from the Antonio Langham-ish scandal. When Alabama went to go hire Mike DuBose, what was the situation for the program? Who were some of the other candidates that were considered at the time?
Well, the situation was that there was a new president, new athletic director. Gene did not, Gene had chosen to retire after his seventh year, had won 70 games, had been very successful. Didn't get along particularly with the administration. Had a ranch in Texas and went back to it. So, Gene did not endorse Mike in the way that, say, Dean Smith endorsed Bill Guthridge to be his successor. It wasn't one of those situations where you had certainly wasn't a coach in waiting situation. And Gene's comment at the time was he didn't want to choose one or the other. I'm not going to speak for Gene. I will give you my impression that Gene probably would just as soon have seen Woody McCorvey get the job at the time, who's an offensive assistant. He's now with Dabo at Clemson. Mm-hmm. In an administrative role, but he wasn't going to come out and hurt Mike's chances or anybody's chances. He just didn't necessarily get involved in
right.
But it wasn't a situation. The people who supported Mike, it was not a situation of where, boy, that's who Gene really wanted to be his successor. I think if he had had his, as Gene would say, if he had had his druthers, he would have picked Woody. But He did not do that, nor, given the state of the administration at that time, was he asked.
Now, Mike was an assistant on the staff. He was the mm-hmm. defensive line coach, yeah. Which led him, in moving into the head coaching position, to keep some of the assistants from the Stallings era and to bring in some new guys, which probably led to some of the issues that we're going to talk about going forward, right?
He was Coach Stallings' defensive coordinator his last year. If you remember, Bill Oliver had jumped ship to Auburn, and Coach Stallings promoted Mike DuBose to defensive coordinator. And by the way, that was the statistically worst defense Coach Stallings ever had, was with DuBose as the defensive coordinator.
Again, that's relative now. That's a team that won a lot of games, including their bowl game. So, you know, it wasn't like that they fell off the face of the earth or that anybody thought that Mike was not a good assistant coach. To the contrary, a lot of people thought Mike was an outstanding assistant coach.
I think Bob Bockrath and the president at the time were hoping somebody like Frank Beamer, they could hire somebody like Frank Beamer, but the fan support was overwhelmingly for Mike, Coach DuBose. So they picked him.
Right. I've got a story here from the Tuscaloosa News in 2010 where Chase Goodbread, no longer with us, but was an excellent writer while he's here, still in town.
He's with us in the world. He's not
dead. Sorry, Chase. Went back and talked with Mike DuBose, and he mentions that he felt like he had great fan support, and the fan support was probably why he got the job, but he did not know if he had the support necessarily from Dr. Sorensen or from Bob Bockrath. which might have put him in a precarious position, kind of as things started off. So 4 years at Alabama, 24 and 23 overall, 16 and 16 in SEC play. The best season certainly would have been 10 and 3 in 1999 when they won the SEC championship that year and went to the Orange Bowl, finished ranked 8th. The other 3 years didn't finish a single season ranked.
No. 99, they had an outstanding year. Mike got a contract extension. To be fair, first of all, in the search, there are a lot of candidates who took themselves out of it because of the scholarship restrictions. They were going to be down. Again, how you calculate how many scholarships you're short is another podcast for another time, because you can limit it on initials, right, or on totals or whatever. But they had lost a pretty significant number of scholarships. In Mike's first year, Mike went through a great many of the pitfalls of the learning process to be a head coach. You know, he had never been a head coach. He stepped in as the head coach at Alabama. I wouldn't say that everything in 1997 falls completely on him, but I would not have been surprised had Coach Stallings, is strictly hypothetical, just knowing Gene, knowing the way that they played, how they would have operated their offense. You know, Mike hired an offensive coordinator who now has a very good reputation, the head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Bruce Arians, but it wanted to open up the offense a little bit. Had they played the way Gene played and handed Sean the ball 30 times a game, they probably could have won 10 games again. They did not. And then you have the usual transition to, you know, some players like the new coach, some players don't, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Mike was probably a little bit overwhelmed in the position in some ways, for in a variety of ways.
And I think he had a little bad luck in that his huge defensive star, Michael Myers, was ruled in it, or they, for reasons, they ruled him ineligible, and he did not get to play that season. He was a monster.
Yeah. We've got a lot.
As in a great player.
Yeah. We have a number of issues that we can talk about coming to the Mike DuBose era, candidates for the low point of the time here. So we can get the high point out of the way. Would it be beating Florida in the 1999 SEC championship game or the Orange Bowl, perhaps? Or against
really, the amazing one was to beat him in Gainesville, mm-hmm, during the regular season, which sort of saved. Mike had lost to Louisiana Tech and was probably, I don't know that they would have fired him mid-season, but his fate was definitely reversed by being able to go down to Gainesville and beat Florida in overtime in Gainesville. So, and from that point, in 99, you know, we've zipped through two seasons. But yeah, by that point in 99, at the end of 99, they were a good team.
Yeah,
they're a really good team. Chris Samuels and, you know, Sean, obviously. And
I want to point out for folks who are younger who might be listening to this, that Orange Bowl was a 35-34 loss to Michigan in which Sean Alexander rushed for 165 yards and 3 touchdowns, but was beaten by a guy named Tom Brady.
Well, yeah, and missing an extra point didn't help either. So if any of you young people that Ben just addressed think that the missing the extra points just suddenly popped up in 2018, you would be mistaken.
Yeah.
The 99 win against Auburn was big, because I think that was the first time we had gone down there and beaten Auburn at their home field. So that was a huge win.
Yeah. The low point, there's probably a few candidates. You might say that the low point came after the end of the DuBose era when the Albert Means judgment came down. You might say it was during that 2000 season. What would you guys peg it as?
Well, the 1999 season, when they were, and really prior to the season, when Mike had gotten involved in an off the field situation that would have had a lot of coaches fired. I don't know that because the expectations for 99 were the expectations after 1999 had been so high that instead after that year going into 2000, Mike got a contract extension that in retrospect, and I say that including myself in hindsight, did not reflect well on the university.
We can be a little bit more specific about the off-field situation. There was an affair with a university employee, right?
Yes.
I think that he at least admitted to that at some point early in the 1999 season.
There was
right?
a financial settlement.
Yeah. So that would be one candidate for one of the low points, probably.
Instead, you know, he received a contract extension, but at the same time, I think, and again, easier to speak in hindsight, but I think he generally had lost a certain amount of respect and certainly certain amount of control of the players, who said, well, coach can do what he wants, why can't I do what I want?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's a tremendous oversimplification, but it's true. And so went out, we're ranked number 3 in the country, and promptly got smacked around by UCLA in the opening game in the Rose Bowl, and really never recovered. They had one good game that season where they beat Ole Miss 40-7, I think. But really, for the most part, in any way you choose to categorize it, the 2000 season was a disaster.
3-8, worst season since the 50s.
And the thing is, you can go 3-8 because you don't have players, but to go 3-8 with a team that was a preseason top 5 team in the country indicates that you at least had some players.
That's a complete meltdown.
That's a debacle. That's what that is.
You know, you have issues when Southern Miss and Coach Jeff Bowers, I think was his name there. Mm-hmm. He actually takes it easy on us at the end because they beat us, I think, 21-0. But you know, the 97 Auburn game was a low point too, because the season hadn't gone the way we thought, and we go in, we had a chance to win that ball game at the end. And, you know, they make a mistake on an offensive play call. Now, who did it? I don't know. But the way we lost that game is a low point to me.
Well, just to lose it, actually, the effort in that game was outstanding.
Right.
Absolutely the best effort they gave all year. Had the game in a position to win. People can argue. There are people out there who will defend anything, and they'll also defend – putting a football in the air, they'd say, "Oh, a screen." They had Alabama had possession, had a third down.
I think it was 3rd and 8.
Yeah, 3rd and 8. But Auburn had one timeout remaining. You run the football, you force them to call that timeout. Instead, they chose a screen pass to a fullback, Ed Sissom, who didn't really handle the ball all that frequently. And Ed fumbled. You know, even if for some – and, you know, Bruce Arians made the call. Doesn't make Bruce Arians a bad coach. No, nobody in the history of football's had the right call every single situation. And there's situational thing. If it had worked out, you know, if Ed doesn't fumble and rambles for 12 yards, people talk about how great a call it is. But strategically, it's not a good call. It's a bad call because the things that can happen, if he just doesn't catch it, you stop the clock. If he catches it and doesn't get the first down, you're no better off than if you had a running play. And if you turn the ball over, then you give Auburn an opportunity to win. Even if you know, it's always been my contention, even if for whatever reason it's just in your brain that you've got to throw the ball instead of hand it to Sean Alexander, you throw it past the first down marker. You don't throw it in the screen pass in the backfield. You know, if you're going to take all that risk, at least guarantee yourself the first down if you complete the pass.
Yeah.
So, anyway, they didn't do that. Very disappointing for people, but I never thought that was the – I mean, it was a disappointing ending if you were an Alabama fan, but I thought actually the effort in that game was good, really good.
Now, you get to that 2000 season that you talk about was so disappointing, where you start out preseason top five. As you mentioned, you lose on the road at UCLA in the opener. Then I believe they beat Vanderbilt. The third game was when they lost to Southern Miss 21-0,
mm-hmm.
After which DuBose offered his resignation privately, and it became public. Very early in the season at that point, obviously would have been not too long after he'd received a contract extension, but the fact that it leaked out there when that was not the intent probably was a sign that he was being undermined in at least some way by someone, right?
Well, certainly there were people who wanted him out. There'd been a change in athletic director. Mal was athletic director.
Right.
Mal Moore was athletic director at that point, not Bob.
And Mal Moore did not accept his resignation.
Did not accept his resignation, told him to go do his job. And so, you know, people at that point, as in any of those situations, you have factions of people. You had factions of people long before the UCLA loss or the Southern Miss loss. They were uncomfortable with all the other stuff surrounding Mike and
right.
wanted Mike gone when he got the contract extension. So, you know, there was a lot of that dynamic going on. But what Mal didn't want was to accept a resignation and have an interim coach and do all that. He knew it wasn't pleasant. But he didn't feel like that would have been the best thing for the program to accept a resignation at that time.
Things get worse then the next week when they lose to Arkansas, right?
Then the really bad stuff starts to happen.
I was obviously too young to be watching this Arkansas game. Reading about it, it sounds like there were a couple of questionable calls in a very close game that probably helped Arkansas and, you know, may have decided the outcome in this game. In any event, it goes down as a loss. And at that point, you're 1-3 with a team that had been top five to start the season.
Right.
It was probably kind of just a matter of time at that point, although it would eventually be a 40-38 loss in Tuscaloosa to Central Florida that would get him fired later that year.
Correct. And then they actually came back. You know, they were close calls in the Arkansas game. They didn't play great, but then they came back, beat South Carolina and Ole Miss the next 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So they're at 3-3, but there was just so much player dissension and turmoil and internal turmoil, and Mike had never been in a situation like that. You know, some people, some head coaches, they've had adversity. They've gotten fired. You know, Gene was famous for, you know, had gotten fired at Texas A&M, and they called him in afterwards, and he's friends with the trustee. You know, it's business. Business is business. And one of the trustees at A&M or Board of Regents said, "Well, Gene, you know, if you had it to do over again, what would you do different?" Gene said, "I wouldn't do anything different." And the regent told him, "We'd fire you again then." So
we can point out here, Mike DuBose has said in the years after he was fired that one thing he would do different is he'd go talk to Gene Stallings about what he needed to know and what he needed to learn.
Exactly. I think that is, in a multifaceted situation, one tremendous problem was that Mike, A, didn't know what to do, and B, didn't know who to ask what to do. So had not been through, really in his coaching career, had not been through that sort of on-the-field adversity, and certainly not as a player. And on a side, since we're discussing Mike Dew is a great player. He was an absolutely outstanding player for Coach Bryant in the 70s. Defensive end, undersized, tough, hard-nosed, worked hard. So you know, people forget that. You know, people when these former Alabama players, whether it's Ray, who was an absolute All-American player, Ray Perkins, Mike was an All-SEC type player, really without, I would say, All-SEC physical ability. You know, he wasn't just wow you when he got off the bus. He just hard-nosed as hell. So, and then Mike Shula, you know, was also a tremendous, got every bit out of his ability as a quarterback, and people don't remember those things.
From everyone I've talked to, he was a really good defensive line coach, and top of the line. I think he went to Tampa Bay with Ray Perkins, I think.
He did, and had good players, but it was tough on him, and when he was hired, people didn't you know, one thing people weren't worried about was work ethic and Mike being tough, and it surprised a lot of people when it didn't exactly turn out that way when he was head coach.
Okay, if you guys are okay with this, I'd kind of like to change up the order that we do this. We usually end by talking about a grade and some lessons learned. In this case, because I think the end of the DuBose era is really important for the start of the Dennis Franchione era and the Albert Means scandal, I'd like to go through best players, grades, and lessons learned now, and then we can finish by talking about Albert Means, and we'll just segue into the Dennis Franchione podcast, which we're recording right after this. You guys who are listening will have to wait a week before you can consume that podcast. You guys okay with that?
Sure, that's fine.
All right, so best players.
Chris Samuels, Sean Alexander.
Cornelius Griffin.
Cornelius Griffin was a really good player. Michael Myers, as he mentioned in his 1 year, was a
Dixon,
really good player.
Dixon?
Tony was a defensive back. Freddie Millins, when he was motivated to be a good player, was a good player.
Kenny Smith.
Yeah, Kenny Smith.
And one of my favorites, Paul Hogan, who all SEC player, just a hard worker, good guy. And I think he's a coach somewhere now. I think he's assistant coach somewhere, Paul Hogan, I think.
Mm-hmm. So they had players. Reggie Grimes, outstanding player. So it wasn't like that they had fallen off the face of the earth. Now, they were not the most talented team in the SEC, probably between Florida and still had good players, although I think Steve hated the players he had in 99, 2000. I don't think Jesse Palmer ever did it for Steve. And Tennessee had obviously national championship level teams.
Yeah.
Won one in 98. Yeah. Andrew Zhao was another. Wasn't highly recruited, but good worker. Mm-hmm. Loved to play against Florida.
Andrew's in coaching too. So.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Lessons learned from this hire. This is something that is probably applied to some of the other hires, but perhaps applies most appropriately to this one. Head coaching experience is important with a job as big as Alabama.
I think so. Like you said, because it was Alabama and not TCU.
Right.
Yeah, I think, although they subsequently hired Mike Shula without head coaching experience, but that was that hire was unusual set of circumstances. So, and we'll deal with that when we talk about Mike Shula.
Any other important lessons here? Maybe something about being your own man when you're putting together a staff? Things like that?
Again, a lot of it goes back to experience. A lot of it goes back to having that experience to rely on. The very best coaches, whether let's say, whether it's Mike Krzyzewski or Nick Saban, they walk in every day with a plan that they know is going to work. And they know it's going to work because it's worked. Mike had never, I'm not going to say he didn't have a plan, but he didn't know if it was going to work or not because he'd never had to implement that plan. So there's a big difference. There's a big, things can go bad for Mike Krzyzewski or for Nick Saban, and you just ride through it. You know what's going on. You know what you're doing. You have a tremendous amount of self-confidence. I think Mike got into situations where he didn't have self-confidence.
And not related to the head coach, but I think you need a really strong – I think we learned we really needed a strong athletic director, one that will make the decisions just like Cecil was talking about and say, I'm not going to listen to y'all. This is who I think is going to be the coach. I think he'll do a good job, and I'm going to hire him.
Yeah. Maybe
Bob
not.
Rath didn't do that.
I was going to say, maybe not something they had when Bob Bockrath was there when he was hired. Probably something they were closer to having with Mal Moore later on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although even with athletic directors, they can change over time and learn things of their own. I don't know if Mal Moore during the Mike DuBose era was the Mal Moore who hired Nick Saban necessarily. If you guys were going to grade this higher, you guys graded Gene Stallings a B. So I'm sorry, Mike DuBose.
You know, Mike shouldn't have been hired, but that's easy for me to say in 2019. But he didn't work out. You know, he didn't finish the course successfully. So I don't think you can give him a passing grade. You can call it a gentleman's D if you want to.
Yeah, that sounds good. And we haven't talked about it because it's going to come into the Franchoni, but the Ronnie Cottrell and Albert Means, and
right.
That's why I give him a, well.
Yeah.
Let's just stick with the D.
Okay. So Albert Means at this point. Mike DuBose has maintained to this day that he didn't know that this was happening. Obviously, it happened on his watch. Obviously, Alabama got hit pretty hard for it. What happened? Can you guys talk about some of the history of it? Because it plays into not just, like we said, this era, but the Dennis Franchione era. It plays into the Tennessee rivalry. There's a lot of little threads that come into this. It also manages to somehow get Kentucky on probation.
They were down there. Who was that? I can't remember the assistant, Kentucky assistant's name now.
Claude Bassett.
Yeah, that's right. Claude was in there. He was in that mix. You know, I spent a long time dealing with the NCAA case, and it's still very complicated. People like to believe whatever simple version they like to believe. So, you know, if you have anybody's got a direct question, I'll try and address it.
What do you believe?
I'm sorry.
What do I think?
What do you believe, having probably as much experience as anyone else?
What do I believe about what aspect of it? I mean, do I think that Logan rolled down and gave $150,000 to Milton Kirk to give to Lynn Lang to give to Albert's family? Probably not. You know. Do I think Logan, who's deceased, do I think Logan liked to talk about stuff like that? I do. I know it for a fact. Logan once called me after midnight. He was very happy because he said he had obtained all the cell phone rights in Russia.
Logan Young was an Alabama booster from Memphis, businessman. Was he a graduate of the – he wasn't a graduate of the university.
He attended Vanderbilt.
Okay. Out of Memphis.
And he was the bag man in this case, or alleged.
Well, no, the bag man would be hypothetically person who delivered funds. He would allegedly have been the source of those funds.
What was Milton Kirk's?
Milton was an assistant coach at Albert's high school, Chesapeake, and Lynn Lang was the coach. So what Logan was prosecuted for was that somehow they were public officials and that he had bribed public officials.
Meaning the high school coach.
Yeah. That case was – Logan was found guilty. That case was under appeal when Logan – died. So do I think that Lynn Lang did some things for the Means family and some for Lynn Lang? Definitely. Absolutely. Do I think some money had to have come from somewhere? Obviously it did, you know. Whether Logan was involved in that or not. He said he wasn't. So, you know, a lot of people think he was.
So what was the evidence that Phil Fulmer then presented that ended up getting Alabama in so much trouble to the tune of, let me read off.
Oh, you know, the NCAA, it's not an issue of what happened or what didn't happen.
Ended up being 5 years of probation, yeah. 2 years of bowl bans, and 21 scholarships. Yeah, it's pretty significant.
It's what they believe happened. Phil had recruited against Alabama on several players, and he felt like that – something Dirty had gone on with Albert Means in terms of presenting actual evidence. You know, I don't know that he had videotape or receipts, but he certainly served as a confidential source for what he believed was going on. So, and again, that's, you know, maybe that's part of his duties as the Tennessee coach if he does that. You know, Steve Spurrier, I think, wasn't always kind about, you know, it's, there's a lot in the case. It's not just Albert. But at least you would think that Steve would have stood up and said, yeah, that's, I told him, you know, and there wouldn't have been that confidentiality situation. Yeah, but it all ended. You know, Albert ended up playing at Memphis, and Mike was gone, and Logan's dead, and Alabama got a lot of probation, and got over it, and went in a bunch of games.
It's always kind of difficult to compare some of these situations, but in the scheme of other NCAA issues, this is probably the last question we'll have in here, and then we'll move on to the Franchione era. In the scheme of other NCAA issues or other NCAA cases, how significant were these sanctions at the same time? Were they pretty heavy? Was this one of the more significant cases since SMU, or is it perhaps a little bit overblown by Alabama fans in some way relative to Southern Cal or Penn State or some of the other scandals that people might know of?
You could not win with scholarship limitations that were imposed.
So it was not overblown.
It's not overblown.
No. I don't think anybody since has gotten even a 2-year bowl ban, but 30 scholarships.
Again, you get complications in terms of initial scholarships and total scholarships and the amount of visits you can take and so forth. But, you know, I always thought that really Fran and Mike Shula didn't do terribly with the hand they were dealt. It didn't do great, but no, they were significant sanctions. And again, there are 1,000 people involved, and every one of those 1,000 people has a different story. And I have a different story, too, because I knew most of the people involved. So doesn't mean I know everything about it. Doesn't mean that I was there or not there when this or that occurred. If I was there and saw something occur, I would have reported on it. So that's where that is.
It certainly took a life of its own. Were we under the repeat offender? I can't remember. Do
you remember? Yes, there was a fairly significant amount of argument about that. It was an issue on appeal, but the NCAA enforcement staff and interprets the bylaws as they enforce. So it didn't work out particularly well. But yes, clearly in that one they were. The argument was really in the previous one. Again, didn't matter. They were going to get hammered, repeat violator or not.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to Dennis Franchione here. Sorry, you guys, if you have to wait a few days to listen to this one. Taylor, do you want to plug the museum real quick?
Yeah. A-Day's coming up. And we've got a brand new exhibit, Wall of Honor, where if you want to look up any player that played for Coach Bryant, not just Alabama folks, but folks that played at Kentucky, Texas A&M, Maryland, it's a multimedia wall. You can go up and click on their name and find out some information about them, watch a video, see some photographs. The museum is open daily 9 to 4. It's only $2 to get in, so come by and see us. Thanks for letting me do that.
Yeah. Be sure to tune back in.